let me ask you guys about any of the breeds that we've talked about so far, or any other large breeds that I've missed. There are 300 and something or other breeds in the AKC. There are probably 1,000 breeds all over the world, so obviously we didn't catch them all. So if you have any questions and I know the answer, or can give you a lead, I'll be happy to talk to you about it. Anybody?
Yeah. Question. Mixed breeds.
Yeah.
Do you just automatically expect to have the intrinsic components of whatever this mutt is made up of? Is it conflicting when they have so many?
It can be conflicting. That's kind of an interesting thought. It can be conflicting. I think it's really important for us to remember that the way a dog looks is does not necessarily show which genetic tendencies it's going to show. So if you have two purebred dogs who mate that are different breeds, and then the next generation they are now mixed breeds and they mix with two other mixed breeds. Now you already have 4 mixed breeds, and then by the time you've gotten to the next generation, you've got like 16, because it keeps on getting higher and higher. These dogs might look like one of the particular breeds. They might look like a Australian Shepherd, and people go, oh my God, that's an Australian. That's why it's always so funny when people come up to folks with mixed breeds and say, oh my God, that looks like it has to be a thus and such.
Yeah.
Could be. Maybe, maybe not. And then they get the DNA down and they go, oh my God, that's not at all what the dog has in it. So if there is a preponderance of one breed in the dog, you can probably expect the dog to have a lot of those breed characteristics. So if it's one half lab and then got, you know, 1/8 border collie and 1/8 pointer or something like that, it's going to probably be showing the one half more than anything else. It is true that the way a dog looks is often has something to do.
Okay,
I'm just going to stop talking.
Sorry. They were going to pee and then Aspen came over and now they're like,
mine. All right, this is worth it, guys. So
I'm really sorry.
We can see Aspen in action now.
I'm really sorry. Not sorry, because this is like the best class for this. But
all right,
you
can go
play. You need to rescue me.
They made no potty. I apologize.
It's okay. You can have it. You can talk to them.
So the black one's name is Winnie, and she's very assertive, and so this is really wonderful to see her using some caution with Aspen.
Aspen,
some restraint, you know.
Aspen, leave it.
I think there's still that respect.
Yay!
Aspen's under shoulder braided.
So they're 7 weeks old?
7.5 weeks now, yeah.
So, you know, 7.5 weeks ago, these were blobs.
What's the brown one's name?
Wheezy. Their names were, the privilege to name them came from their gala at the shelter. So they raised money. We joked that they raised money by somebody very inebriated, donating a lot of money to come up with. So the black one is Winnie, and Winnie and Wheezy.
What are the other ones, the other house, do you know?
No, I don't actually. They looked more Chihuahua, and one of them was very interesting looking. She looked kind of silver, which I had never seen, and she had kind of brownish eyebrows. Whereas Winnie looks a little like a stumpy Minpin or something. Who knows?
Maybe not.
And she's they saw my giant dog, and they weren't aligned. They're interested. You know, I have to be really careful because mine's really predatory, so it's very much a management, very much a management game all the time.
Okay, let's pick him up.
Okay, good job.
Not that we want to. We don't know why I'm here and watch there.
Oh, that was so good. Hi, Aspen. You were such a good girl. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Is that really good?
Yeah. It's fine. You might move it over a little bit because it gets too much of that light in there. So just move it that. Maybe a little bit more. There we go. Okay. All right, so we're going on to small dogs, but just to let you know, because I didn't group small dogs necessarily as breeds. And the reason is because there's the smallness of the dog almost overrides the breed tendencies. But if you have any questions about large dogs in the middle of all this stuff, feel free. You know, it's not like that's now a closed topic. By the way, Pomeranians in the Victorian era, which would be 1870s, were 30 pounds.
Wow.
So these are a bred down Spitz breed. And we talked about the Kiklai and dogs like that. I think in the case of these dogs, what they did is they just bred small to small. So they would get a Pomeranian that was 30 pounds, and one was 25 pounds, and one was 20 pounds, and they breed those two together and like that. And so I guess Queen Victoria really liked them. And so they became small dogs, and that's how they became small dogs. So every once in a while, you'll get a throwback, and the dog is 20, 25 pounds, and it will be a throwback to the original breed. So as far as I know, Chihuahuas have never been large dogs. They have been deer. You're supposed to laugh. They look like deer caught in the headlights, is what I'm saying.
Well, there's the deer Chihuahua.
Yeah, so and they're deer type. There are two types of Chihuahuas. There are the apple-headed Chihuahuas and the deer-headed Chihuahuas. So this is Flocka. Flocka is a deer-headed Chihuahua. At this moment in time, she is waiting for Trisha to come in, and her ears are as high as they can possibly get. Because she's like, where is she? I don't know where she is. That's when we were in Mendocino. Oh, okay. This is Flocka.
Why is life so hard for me?
Did you hear what she said?
Why
is life so hard for me?
Why is life so hard for me?
I swear this is what she thinks most of the time, you know, that everybody else can cope. If I cough, she goes into the bedroom where she leaps onto Trisha's lap. You know, I can sneeze, it's okay, but if I cough or choke or do anything else, so half the time if I got a cough, I race to the bathroom.
You don't
want to
scare them.
Why is life?
Okay. All right. So, what happens with the small dogs is people think of them as being toys. They don't think of them as being real dogs, and of course they are real dogs. Anybody here met or know anybody who says, "Oh, you know, I don't like little dogs. I like big dogs." I like big dogs because they're dogs.
Yeah, totally.
You know, small dogs are not dogs. So, they're, and the funny thing is the opposite that you get is people who say, "Well, my dog thinks it's a person." Particularly with small dogs. No, they don't. They don't think they're a person. I don't think they think about whether they're a dog either. They don't go, "I am a dog." They go, "I am Aspen."
Yeah.
In fact, it's probably something more along the line for her. It's more like, "I am Queen of Universe." You know. But you know, the tendency of people to anthropomorphize dogs in that way is a really dangerous tendency, because to say I don't like small dogs because the small dogs are all yappy, and I've had lots of clients who say the small dogs ask for it when they get attacked and all that kind of stuff. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it was the small dog's fault. He yapped. That's why my dog bit him.
Oh.
Yes. So, you know, they're dogs. They're as much dogs as anybody else, and they deserve they have the right to live as much as any other dog has the right to live. So they're sentient. So there are two different kinds of small dogs. There are small dogs that are bred for a purpose. So that would be like terriers, which we talked about last time or the time before. And then there are sleeve guards. The Tibetan breeds are called sleeve guards. And what happened with a Shih Tzu or a, mostly Shih Tzus, Lhasa Apso is a little too big for this, but with the Shih Tzus, actually the monks would keep them in their sleeves and they would actually protect the monks. Because they were a monk didn't mean they'd never been attacked. And so that's what they're bred to do. So they're really pretty and they got a lot of hair and all that kind of stuff, but they also had a tendency to be guardian dogs. Now Lhasa Apsos are far more of a guardian dog than, and they were actually guarded the castle. I think the first Lhasa Apsos came over, they were actually a trade from like the Queen of England to the High Lords of somebody or other, and then they came to the West that way. Then there are dogs that are bred for companionship. There are also a lot of accidents, right? But there are dogs bred for companionship, and that would include about like a French Bulldog, which I put in here in the small dog category. Even though they're not as small as some, they're still pretty small. And they retain a lot of their bully dog characteristics. But they were bred for companionship. Can you imagine breeding something that can't breathe and can't move for anything other than companionship? You know, Cavalier King Charles Spaniels have been bred for companionship for hundreds and hundreds of years, not thousands, but hundreds of years. Pomeranians and Chihuahuas, all bred for companionship. Now, in the Middle Ages and slightly beyond, what they would have is they would have dogs like lurchers outside, and they would have the small companion animals inside. And they were very definitely the different types of pets. One was cosseted, and the others were expected to earn their living. And that was, so there was a really different way of looking at it. Some of the small dogs, like the Poms, were bred down for much larger dogs, but some of them, as I say, were not. So why do we get them? Well, we get them primarily for companionship. And I loved this picture of the monkey with the dog. We get them because we want to hug them. I mean, watching all of you guys with the puppies, what were you doing with the puppies? Hugging them. Yeah, it's not just holding them like, oh, this is cute. It was hugging them, holding them. And these are animals that were not necessarily bred for hugging and holding. Dogs don't like that naturally. So over the eons, what's happened is most, if not all, definitely not all, small dogs have started to like to be hugged. So you get a dog like Flocka who is not happy unless she's in a lap being hugged. And because for thousands of their generations, this is what we've been breeding them to do. And then, you know, you get your dog trainer who says, well, when the dog barks at another dog, don't pick it up. Pick it up! Yeah. You know, pick it up. This is the dog that was bred to be picked up. Pick it up, pick it up, pick it up, get it out of the way. Stuff it in your coat. Whatever you need to do to in order to stop the dog from feeling like it's prey is a good thing, you know. But we wanted to hug dogs, and so we bred dogs to hug. And if you've ever read The Other End of the Leash, have you read that?
What?
The Other End of the Leash, Patricia McConnell. It's really a good book. She put it out several years ago, probably about the same time I put my book out. And it's very good. She's got some great pictures of people hugging dogs and dogs going, which is what most dogs do when you hug them. They kind of look like, I'll put up with this because you feed me and I know you like me somehow, you know. But they're not bred to do that, and these little dogs usually are. We also like to talk to them, and we like them, the fact that they listen to us and they believe everything we say. Or they don't tell us when they don't believe it. And we also get them to help us exercise, you know, to help people exercise. So I was at, I help people with their Apple products, and it's one of the things that I volunteer my time to do, like Apple iPhones and stuff like that. And I work with seniors. At this point, it's getting to be like, you work with what? But I work with people who are older than me, or mentally older than, I don't know. But one of my clients has a little dog named Toby. He's really a cute little dog. And I helped her yesterday put her Echo in, you know, the Alexa thing. And she was so excited about it. She was like, oh my God, this is going to be so much fun. I really like this. And I said, what are you expecting this to do? And she said, I want to talk to it. I said, you're expecting her to talk back? And she said, well, yes, you can have conversations with her.
Oh.
And I said, well, really, you can't. You ask her to do things, and she does them for you, but you have to set them up. And so I'm setting it up, and I said, Alexa, tell me the weather. And then she said, well, can't she look up my relatives? And I said, what do you mean, look up your relatives? and she said, well, you know, she named a name. She said, Alexa, look up so-and-so, this name. And Alexa said, I'm afraid I can't do that. And she said, well, why can't you do that? And I said, well, Alexa needs access. If this is a very famous person, maybe Alexa can look into this or whatever. But this morning she texted me and said that, well, we're having conversations. Usually they're along the lines of, I don't understand what you're saying. But most of us use our dogs for this, and it's kind of interesting that she's got Toby and she doesn't talk to Toby. I talk to my dogs all the time.
Yeah.
I'm constantly talking to them. So I use them for conversations, but she doesn't use Toby for this, and I think Toby would be much, much better. Toby would look interested, which Alexa doesn't. Alexa looks like a tube, you know. And our it is funny. Anybody here got an echo? Anybody? It is funny, because if you say the word Alexa, it says, the little blue light goes on and goes, you're like, oh my God, they're listening to me. But you know,
sometimes they just join in and don't say anything.
Yes, and some of them laugh apparently.
Oh God,
yes, some of them laugh. Yeah, there was it's a glitch in the system. They just start to laugh.
Ew.
Like, if I had that, then we use ours for Alexa, play some music for the dogs. That's what we use ours for.
I had a friend who couldn't figure out how to hack it, so when the babysitter was there, he was overlisting their conversation with a boyfriend and commenting from.
Oh my God.
And he got grounded, but I'm sure my friend laughed hysterically for sure.
And then she hopefully threw the echo away. Yeah.
I just had a question about talking to your animals. I talk to my dogs all the time, but
yeah, we can say this in this closed room.
Yeah. But I read something recently referring to talking to puppies and how they will learn to tune you out or something. And I don't know. That was kind of.
I actually disagree with that. Where did you get that?
I think it was sent out on like the volunteer thing on the shelter website for volunteers.
Well, what it could mean is that if you chant at your dogs when you're trying to tell the dog to do something, so like if you go sit, they definitely, that will lose all of its meaning. But saying, I just love you, Aspen, you're the cutest little booger in the entire world, that isn't going to do anything at all except for make both of you feel good. So I think it depends on the context. Yes, you certainly can talk at your dog and have it not do much good, or you can do what many, many, many owners do, which is to assume that if you say sit once, they don't hear it, and by the time you've said it 15 times, they should understand.
Yeah, I think it was sent out because they were saying that a lot of the puppies that were being adopted out were getting returned for biting too much because they're not relating, you know, ouch or something to like
don't hit your head against
whatever it was. I think
okay,
that's
weird.
Yeah.
That's, no,
I mean, I could find it for you, but it might take a little bit. So
if you could.
Yeah, okay.
That would be really nice because that is a
great. I thought it was interesting because I was always told, you know, I don't know, just kind of gets the dog used to your temperament too. I like talking to my dogs because I think it kind of
helps. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with talking to your dog. I mean, I'm trying to think of it. I'd love to see the thing because maybe there is something that I'm just missing there.
There might be too. But I just, since you had brought up talking to the dogs, I was like, what?
How many of you guys don't talk to your dog?
I talk back in the dog voice. I answer myself.
Many, many, many of us. Yes, I do too. I say, oh, she says this.
Yeah.
I say this, you say that. And especially if Trish is there too. Right. So we're having this four-way conversation. Yeah.
My feeling is that, I mean, I talk to my dog a lot, but especially when I'm taking her for a walk. And my feeling that there's some way that enhances the bond. Do you think that's true?
I think it can, certainly. Absolutely. I think it's another. Now, if you're using it as a voice leash, that's not necessarily a good thing. If you're going, don't pull, don't pull, don't pull, don't pull, don't pull. But if you're just chatting with them, I think it probably does enhance. I think almost all communication enhances a relationship. And there are times, however, when we, if the dog is very interested in something else and not interested in us, they're probably just hearing us as a, on the perimeter. And babbling probably doesn't help that.
Right.
So, but, you know, just a little conversation bits is probably really great. I don't see anything that could be wrong with that. Now, there are a lot of trainers who talk to the dogs, I think, too much. And what they're trying to do is that they're trying to actually get a behavior. So they're trying to get a behavior, but they surround all of that with so much verbiosity, that's not a word, verbiage, that it ends up getting lost. What you want the dog to do gets lost in all that talking. So if I was training a dog to sit or come or down or stay, I'm going to definitely put space around each of the words that I'm teaching so that it becomes unique and identifiable on its own. So if you're like a lot of people and you go come 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 come, there's nothing around that like to delineate one come from another come, and the dog ends up thinking perhaps that this is a very very long word, you know.
And it could be overwhelming.
It could be very overwhelming for sure.
Do you think that rescue dogs that are being brought in from other countries like Taiwanese dogs, do they have an extra set of challenge because it's a different language, or do they catch on fast and?
I think a lot of that depends. That's an interesting question. I do think that dogs know their own language. They know Hispanic or Spanish, or they know, you know, anything in Tagalog, whatever. But I also think that if the body language is similar with each language, they're going to pick up really fast. But if there's different body language, it will be a real challenge for them, because all the studies have shown that dogs pick up body language before they pick up verbiage. So verbals don't matter nearly as much. When you're calling a dog, moving backwards is probably going to be more of a cue to the dog than saying the word come. Or if you do this to come, that is going to be more important than the word come. And just as a training note, if you're trying to teach the dog to actually do something, using your word only, you always put the word first before you put the body language. So, Aspen, can you come here for a sec?
No.
I'm too busy now. Aspen, come here.
I'm sure you worked hard.
Stretch for a second. Sit. Aspen, sit. Down. So she knows the words more than she knows the and we kind of taught her that, I don't know, just as a game. And she obviously is very verbal herself. So did you think you needed something for that? That was nothing. That was just nothing. Heel. Down. Wait. I don't know. Good. Go to bed. That's fine. Go to bed. All the way. Go to bed. Oh, if it's from her, then it's right.
It was a suggestion from her that they...
Oh, that people talk too much.
Yeah, something like that. So, I don't know, maybe you can just clarify it. Yeah. So
well, essentially what we're talking about is if you don't... You talk to make your bond happen, which is really good, but if you're trying to actually train your dog, then... you probably don't want to talk as much. As I said, you leave space around things, and you don't tend to repeat over and over and over again. Because we've all seen trainers who just really talk so much that it's just like a waterfall of verbiage. And it's very different from what you're talking about, because what you're talking about is just continuing the bond.
Maintaining the connection.
Yeah, so does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's why I wanted to just clarify, like, what is acceptable and what, you know.
Everything's acceptable. Whatever the hell you want to do.
what they're saying.
Yeah. So if I'm training her, I'm not gonna be doing very much talking at all. But if we're just chatting,
Okay.
And back to what we're talking about with using foreign language for the dog. When I got my golden from Taiwan, I had a friend at work do phonetically all the commands, simple commands. In the dialect that she would have heard.
Yeah.
And I would say the word in the Chinese, and then I would say it in English to get her used to it, but I don't know. I don't know that it made a difference. Because I think it's like they're just learning like any language they learned.
Yeah. Well, they're not thinking of the word. If you wanted the dog to learn sit and you said scrimmage.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fine. In fact, what's her face? The scary one. She plays this game about apples and oranges, and she has you teach somebody else and somebody in class something like a cue, but you call it apples. And so it's not making any sense to you, and it doesn't make any sense to the person either. And what she's trying to point out is that when we say something, just because we know what we mean doesn't mean the dog knows what it means. So I probably, if I got a dog from Taiwan, I'd probably immediately start to just speak in English because that's much more comfortable for me. And the dog would pick it up pretty quickly. But as I say, again, body language is probably going to be more important. And if you smile and if the dog has learned that a smile means a good thing. I mean, John Rogerson does this whole thing with teaching a dog to recognize a smile, which is absolutely hilarious because he holds a treat up in front of his face. And he, with a big smile, great big weird smile. such a weird smile. It almost looks like, you know, like a kind of thing. And then he gives the dog a treat, right? So he's got this treat, he smiles, he gives the dog a treat, then he has another treat, and then he goes, oh, and takes the treat away. So what he's teaching the dog to do is A, watch his face, which is a really important consideration, and then B, understand that when the person is pleased or displeased. Which is kind of interesting. It's a little bit like Siri, you know,
right?
Learning your facial recognition and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, I've seen him do it, and he is absolutely a master trainer. He's absolutely spectacular. But it is really funny watching him do that smile.
What did you say his name is?
John Rogerson. He's written several books. I'm afraid I don't like his writing style very much, but I've seen him in seminars many times. And he's I've also gone out for drinks with him, which was a real mistake. He's British. And then, you know, they can drink you under the table anymore. We both had to do talks the next day. Oh my God. It was terrible. So yeah, and he's really a fantastic trainer. Most of his training is done in China now. He actually takes groups over to China, and they take street dogs and they train street dogs, and then they bring them back and put them up for adoption. I believe that's it. What he does anyway. Yeah. So, but he actually will take a whole group of usually fawning women. Pretty sure he likes that a lot. But he is. If you ever get a chance to see him, he's getting older now, but so am I. But he's really good. He's really good. He does not use slides. He does not use video. He just stands there and expects you to listen to everything he says, and you can't go to the bathroom, and you can't get, you know, it's just, but he's really good. He's really worth it.
Trish, is the one that you said the mean one, when you talk about the apples and the oranges, is that Suzanne Clothier?
That's Suzanne Clothier, the scary one.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I love her books.
She's wonderful. She's a really wonderful trainer, too. She's just great. She just doesn't like people very much. Yeah. So if you do something she doesn't like, man, you're in trouble. No, she's fantastic. Another really good person to see.
What's
the name? Suzanne Clothier, Clothier.
Behaviorist as well?
She has German Shepherd. She lives...
Did you spell that last name?
C-L, like clothed. Clothier. Clothier. Yeah. And she does come out here once a year. So it may be coming up. Huh?
How do you find out about these things where trainers and dog events?
You can go to the APD website, APDT website, except I don't know if she's got on that stuff over there. they don't like her very much because she uses pinch collars, but she's there, and she, this woman named Catherine
Horn
who brings
but
her out.
I emailed her, so she's right. Coming actually April 24th. I'm sorry, 28th and 29th.
Oh, there?
No.
So that's probably a weekend, and it's probably a weekend you're signed up for a class here, right?
What's her name?
That's a Sue Ann Clothier.
Oh, but it was. Oh,
yeah, that's when she's coming.
Yeah.
Catherine Horn's dog's in the school.
Yes, Catherine is really, like, really good friends with her, so she brings her out every year.
I think East Bay is the same.
Oh. So, yeah, I mean, she's definitely worth seeing.
Yeah, she's doing a seminar on the 28th and 29th.
She has everybody's trying to monetize things, so she's got this.
I don't know anything about her, I just know
she has an evaluation process she goes through. I don't think it has to do with shelters. I think it's really evaluations for pet dogs and dogs like that. Because I don't think she has any kind of connection to shelters. I think I probably told you, it was really funny. We were both speaking at APDT, and I sat next to her at a table, and she's very intimidating to me, and I don't know why, she just really is. And she goes, oh, Trish, I really like your stuff. And I'm like, thank God. Because we're both practical. You know, neither one of us is kind of pie in the sky sort of thing. We're both very practical. But if you get a chance to see her, she's really good.
As long as you don't have a class ever.
Well, that's going to be up to you. Then I may or may not forgive you. Okay, so common problems with small dogs. Barking, lap guarding, snapping at strangers, snapping at family members, and leash reactivity, and all these things that you see in big dogs are multiplied in small dogs, and it's much harder to stop them in small dogs. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to modify the behavior of little dogs, as you know, because they're little dogs. Because all the things that we would tell somebody with a large dog, stop paying attention to the dog, you know, make sure the dog sleeps in the place of your choice, make sure the dog does not get it as much as, you know, it has to work for all the things. If you try to tell people who have a small dog to do that, they can keep it up for maybe how long, do you think? 20 minutes? Yeah, not very long. Not very long. And I'm not even sure that it's even going to work if they do it very long. So it is very difficult. I love small dogs, and I really enjoy working with them. So usually what I end up doing is teaching alternate behaviors more than anything else, because it's so hard to actually stop or, you know, inhibit a behavior with them. So this is leash reactivity in a small dog. I had many videos to choose from. People have the small dogs, the dogs just bark. Most people don't know what to do with this, and it's very difficult to know what to do with this, you know. What I would probably do if it caught me off guard is pick the dog up. I mean, it's just stop the dog that way. But again, people have been told over and over and over, don't pick the dog up, because that just makes them feel more powerful. Well, then hold it like a football. Put the head right under here. That works really well. No.
I've had many, many people in my dog, who have little dogs, and the dog is doing that, and they're like, oh, sorry, they just have little dog syndrome. And
I know, it's a really good excuse.
And I'm just like, okay, like, I'm not going to stop. But you, and you're just
not
going to react to dogs, so I'm not going to stop at all, but I'm just like, okay.
She would be, both of her brothers are really reactive, really badly reactive. And she would have had that too if I'd have let her do it, because it's so much fun. If you're a Pomeranian and all you really want in this world is to get an adrenaline hop, you know, that just all she wants is like, oh boy, bark, 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 bark. That's what she likes to do. Then, you know, then you have to work concertedly at it to make sure that she does not do it. And so she's never done it. But if I'd gotten her when she was 3 years old and she already had leash reactivity, it would have been really hard to stop it. Because again, it gives her a buzz. She likes that buzz. They become addicted to it. So here's one.
I thought
this
was
from the class that
other dog as well as the handler.
It was. It was both. It was both. Yeah. Actually, yes, I'm gonna have a man come up now. Any minute. Oh, there comes Dave.
Dave, can I see your dog?
Oh, wow.
Oh.
So, this little dog actually started off as an absolutely delightful dog, and by the time we were finished with him, he was like... HSSV, I came up with a program that I thought that they should, and they did. So they have a tendency to not euthanize. They will work, but they don't put the dog up for adoption until they've worked on the dog. And he got a lot better. But at first, he was just great with me handling him, and then I looked at his teeth, and he said, no, you can't do that. So he actually got pretty bad, and you can see how bad he was with strangers. So he didn't know me. This was the first time I'd ever met him. So this behavior was just a behavior that had to do with probably the leash being put on him, and the fact that it was a guy coming up to him. So this was a pretty common one. Oh, and this is a foster dog. That actually has got a really interesting form of kind of lap guarding, but it's not lap guarding. So they didn't know what to do with this behavior.
Right.
What do you do with this behavior?
Huh?
Okay, here's where we come with the small dog. Don't let the small dog on the couch, right? No, that's it. So what was the dog doing first?
Was it seeking attention?
Yeah, it was getting pissed off when the person left,
right?
So, and then he wasn't guarding the lap as much as he was saying, bring the lap back, as somebody said.
Yeah.
Is bring that lap back. I want that lap again.
He's
demanding
the lap. He's demanding the lap.
Yes, he's going, you know, I don't care who's got the lap, I want it. You know, so what would you do with that?
So find it before you get up.
I think I would do that, yeah. I would probably have a pocket full of... pocket full of little treats, and I might put a treat on the get up, and actually as I got up I'd put it on the couch, find that, and then get up and move. So that after a while, so that's all what I'm talking about with alternate behaviors. Rather than trying to stop that behavior a la like Cesar Millan or something where you just will hold the dog down, I think I would go, oh no, look, when I get up something good is going to happen. Boop, here goes that little treat. And then he would end up going, okay, get up. Anytime you want to, you can get up. Here's a very fearful dog. He's in a, that's the bed he was using. But he was in a crate, and he felt trapped, and he also felt like he had to protect his place that he was. He was a very, very poor little girl.
Well, he kept looking, but he seemed kind of doing a little turn, but wanting to make sure he could see where you were.
Yeah, he was definitely doing that. What we did with him is I left him in the crate and put the crate right down beside me and let him come out when he wanted to, and then he would go back inside, and then he'd come back out, and then he'd come back in, and then I sat down on the floor. And it took about 2.5-3 hours before he actually allowed me to touch him. And then he was kind of okay. So then we placed him with a family with children, of course. No.
That would be my
little Oh, boy. Okay. So other problems associated with small dogs are being chased by other dogs. This is a really, I mean, there's a reason small dogs are afraid of big dogs, and it's because small dogs are often chased by big dogs, and they can be killed by small dogs, by big dogs. So... But big dogs are not doing this to be naughty. They're doing it because it's small and it runs away, and so it's a lot of fun. So you can't blame either dog for what they're doing. You just have to prevent them from doing it. And then another thing that happens to the dogs is the smaller dogs are bullied. So it's really wonderful if you have a family with small dogs and big dogs, if the big dogs know how to play properly and can actually, be nice in their play with the small dogs. So small dog problems are not necessarily different from big dog problems, but the behavior modification also has to be really different. So when doing any kind of behavior modification, what you do is you control the environment, manage the dog, and then you train. That's you're always looking for that. Control the environment, manage the dog, and train. And if you can't do one of those three things, particularly controlling the environment, you're probably doomed to disaster. So that's the same thing with the small dog, except for controlling the environment becomes much more difficult when you're dealing with normal human beings and their normal desires for their dog, their small dog that they have. So their adjustment is different. They're more at risk. At the same time, their owners won't do as much to try to modify the behavior because they have their own expectations of who this dog is and what they want. So I probably have said this, but I have come to the conclusion that the reason most behavior modification tools don't work is because we don't use them. And I'm speaking of things like bark collars, e-collars, harnesses, muzzles, all those kinds of stuff. What you do is you say, okay, I'm gonna put my dog on this piece of equipment, whatever it might be. And you do that religiously for 2 months. And then after that, you stop doing it, and the dog behavior comes back up again. And this is true of all behaviors, is that, I don't know how to say this to make it sound a little bit newer than it is, because it just is like, I mean, I've gotten bark collars for her in the past, but I don't want to put them on her. I just don't want to put them on her. I have clients who've gotten muzzles for their dogs, and the muzzle sits in the box because they don't want to put the muzzle on. So most of the time, what we hope for is magic to solve the behavior problems, and what we actually get are kind of half-solved problems, usually enough so that the person can live with the dog, and they just kind of leave it at that. So I just think that getting all these pieces of equipment that people get, that I get, and all that, the reason that it doesn't work is because we don't make it work.
I have huge issues with French bulldogs in my area. They're tending to get more and more aggressive and so popular. And
they're like the fourth most popular dog.
I know. And it's like they're, it's really hard to muzzle. I have a really weird.
You just need a Kleenex to go around.
Right? So it's like, and you get the same attitude of people who don't do as much and different things, and it's just.
Well, here's the other thing with small dogs is that they don't think their dog can cause any damage. And they're right in that a small dog bite is not going to kill you. It's not even probably going to send you to the hospital, although if it's in the face, it will.
It bit my employee's finger off.
Yeah.
Boston, it did breaking up a Frenchie Boston fight, break up, bit off the tip.
Oh my god.
Yeah, but I mean, but people don't take it seriously because they don't think this stuff is serious, but it is serious. And a dog that bites, no matter how big it is, it's serious. And that little bitty dog that you said, I said, let me give me the assessor hand, that little dog probably had 5 teeth. But even those 5 teeth can actually hurt. So it's like this expectation that the little dogs are going to be leash reactive. You know, that is not an acceptable solution. Just to say, oh, he's like that. It's not a way to stop the behavior from occurring again. And the same thing is true with a dog that you send to a groomer. People wonder why groomers or people who take care of their dogs say, no, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
But can't be that bad. Yes, it can. It can be pretty bad. Yes.
So do you find that, I guess I shouldn't generalize, but do you find that in general people with smaller dogs train less?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Because I see it all the time. I have friends that are just
the bigger the dog, the more they have to be trained. People do what they have to. Dogs do what they can get away with. And absolutely that's true. So, you know, if you see a small dog that's highly trained, it's amazingly wonderful. Yeah?
The question would actually be, what muzzle do you use for natural dogs?
There are muzzles for flat-faced dogs. None of them work very well because they already have such horrible breathing apparatus that they, you know, you're going to cut off the airwaves. So you really can't use a muzzle. What I would use for a dog like that is probably the thing we talked about before, the fox pro. Outfox.
The what is it?
Outfox.
It's like a
mask. It's just that mask.
The fox tails
Yeah. And the reason you would is because it's going to impede it. It won't stop them from biting. But it definitely, because it's got a little, right here is kind of a layer like a, maybe 4 layers of cloth right there, as opposed to the 1 layer all around here. So it actually will impede it quite a bit. And you're probably going to stop him from thinking he can do it. So I would probably use that. But it's very much like a cat. You know, they have cat muzzles. But you leave a cat muzzle on a cat too long and they die. Because they can't breathe well enough. You know, they have to be able to take in enough air. And they put it out. You know, they're like dogs, they don't sweat, so it all has to come in and out through their mouth. And so if you close their mouth or you impede their ability to breathe, you may be sensing, like that one that died in the plane.
I have one that's by RC, I don't know if you've seen that one. I mean, it's a whole face. But it
kind of goes around like this, yeah.
Yeah, it's a kind of, yeah, and it has a slit here, but I don't think I've ever seen one. There's such a mask on the dog. I mean, it's very much also like, you know,
Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah. They can't see. And I mean, yeah, if that's something, you know, you put a respiratory thing on your face and it's just annoying as hell. It's pretty great.
The Boomas might make some.
Yeah. I actually got, came in and asked me to do the fitting in my shop. I'm like, I don't really custom fit dogs for muzzles that are aggressive or have my employees do it.
What I would probably do, you know, one of the things that is really nice to do is to get a good, really thick pair of gardening gloves, because that will do an awful lot to protect you. You know, the one like rose cutting gloves, someone said, look at that. Isn't that awful and ugly? That's from when they took the blood, you know, when they gave me that drip. She goes, can you come and look at this? I don't think I'm getting this right. So another nurse comes over.
No,
it looks okay. Is it okay? Do you think? Then they call somebody else over. This is my arm. You got these.
I have to do my eye.
So yeah, is somebody else going to do my eye? Yeah. I don't want one of these people to do my eye.
Is the recovery good?
Yeah, it's fine.
Not physical?
No. No, it's not. It's actually fine. But it's
amazing.
It's just, I don't like it, but hey, it was fine. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's just that if a small dog bites, it hurts. And if a small dog can go into bite quarantine, a small dog can be euthanized. Small dogs get away with murder. They're not euthanized nearly as much as big dogs, but that is because the amount of damage they can do is much, much, much less. But it still can be traumatic, and it can wreck a relationship completely. If you lose trust in your dog, then that's that's not good. If you think your dog is going to bite you, then you don't have, you can't have trust in your dog, and that's not an okay thing to be, you know, to have. So with socializing small dogs and other dogs, it's just as important as with big dogs. And by that, I really mean that it may or may not be important at all times. So the person with the pit mix that I saw yesterday, she's really worried about getting her dog to enough socialization, you know, enough like dog parks and stuff like that. Dog loves dog parks and does really well, but she can't handle frustration. So, but people who do this with big dogs, they what they think they're doing is they're getting the dog used to playing with other dogs, which is fine, but they're not getting the dog used to not playing with other dogs, which is better, actually. So it's the same thing with small dogs. They need to understand that they cannot, that they do not have access to all dogs at all times. That's really important. Now, having said that, I've noticed, and maybe you have not noticed this, so I'd really like to know, that small dogs tend to get along better with other dogs. Once you put them in a play yard together, they don't tend to posture quite as much. They do posture, but they don't tend to try to develop these instantaneous relationships, and they do tend to play more, a little bit more like puppies.
Yeah. And if they don't actually bite. Like if two of them are going at it, don't you feel like they make a lot of noise and that? Yeah. But I'm never breaking two dogs, little ones apart.
Yeah, I actually think it now. I know somebody, people have had, you know, small dogs have actually bitten other small dogs, particularly in a family situation. They have done that, but I've just seen that they can tend to be a little bit more socially apt. That's the word I want when they're playing.
At our shelter, they'll often put small dogs together in runs, whereas they would never do that with big dogs.
Yeah.
You know, to have them together for companionship or whatever it is. It totally seems like a crapshoot, and then all of a sudden it's working in there.
I saw that all the time. They have three or four together.
I'm trying to think why this might be. And I'm thinking maybe the reason is because they're more neotenized.
Mm-hmm.
By their nature, they're neotenized. So they behave more like puppies. We treat them more like puppies. Their end behavior is like puppies. So that would mean their social behavior would also be a little bit more like puppies. So if you get a terrier and you treat it like one of these small dogs, and it's not a Yorkie or a Silkie, because those dogs are toys. They're really small dogs. They're not really terriers. Tell them that. The rat would kill them, I think, rather than the other way around. But if you put a Jack Russell Terrier, which is technically a small dog, in with a bunch of small dogs, you probably are gonna get an issue. If you put a lot of small dogs like Shih Tzus and Lhasa Apso's and Chihuahuas and all that, then they're probably gonna play fine. Chihuahuas, by the way, apparently were actually bred to do what they do best, which is keep people's feet warm. That's what they're bred to do. There's a reason they like to go underneath covers. So they were supposed to keep people's feet warm and their bodies warm at night and all that kind of stuff. So it's really, that's all they can figure they were bred for. And food.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're bred to eat as well. So anyway, I'm going to get rid of that stuff. Okay. Socializing small dogs with people, the emphasis should be generalizing carefully. It's a big world out there. Little dogs need to think it's a safe place. It is intrinsically an unsafe place for small dogs. Again, I'm not going to make you do it, but just get all the way down on the floor. Lie down on the floor. It's not even crawling on the floor. And look at the world from down there, and you'll see what a big world this is. And you'll see how terribly scary it is.
It smells really bad, too.
Yeah, well, they think it smells good. That's why I think that movie, that little camera, is going to be really fun. You know, because you get
you'll have to show us video.
I will, definitely, if anything works out. It's probably going to be just a kind of bump, 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 bump. And we'd all get dizzy.
You'll see a lot of feet.
We'd all get dizzy, you know. So, but it would be, if it has some kind of a stabilizer in it, it should be good, but I don't know if it will. So little dogs, just like anybody else, don't need to meet hundreds of people. They need to meet a variety of people, and there's nothing wrong with having them meet people when they're in arms, like your puppies were, and then having people sit down and all that kind of stuff. So keep in mind that single event learning is more powerful when a dog is young, whether it's a big dog or a small dog. And facilitated learning is also very powerful. It's really powerful with small dogs. If one small dog, her, barks, the other dogs will have a tendency to bark. Facilitated learning is extreme. These are if they are neotenized, if we're assuming that most of these guys are neotenized, that's one of the ways they learn, is they learn through facilitation. If somebody does it, somebody else is going to do it. This is not necessarily quite as true with a large dog, although it's still true to a certain extent. If they're buddies, they will definitely do it. But it is also very true with small dogs. And, you know, so those are things that are important. House training is a big behavior problem with small dogs. And it can be as difficult as it is with a puppy, only it can never end. I have met many, many people with small dogs who actually are fine with their dogs going to the bathroom in the house. Anybody else know people like that?
Well, I've had customers brag to me that their dogs don't go outside, but they use weed pads. They use the weed pads.
Yeah,
and they brag that their dogs won't go outside to pee or poop. Okay, but they're clean in the house.
I actually know a lot of people who just kind of the dogs go behind the couch, but they're little,
yeah.
You know, the little dog with little poops, they don't care.
So if you have a little dog as an adult and still sometimes pees in the house, is it just something that you should teach them where to go instead of trying to poop outside? Or do you start with, like you do with a dog? You just like, every 20 minutes you're going, you know?
Well, it shouldn't be every 20 minutes if
but
it's
I mean,
an adult. It's every two, if it is a male or female?
It's male.
I'd use a belly band and take them out every 2 to 3 hours.
Okay.
Just start all over.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
My uncle and aunt found dogs like
Well, somebody's got to buy them.
Yeah, a bunch of idiots. Anyways, and the dog will go to the bathroom on the different tape and in the car. Like, you know, when you pull to cover in the back, you know, when people poop.
It's puppy mill. The dog never did anything. How old was the pup when they got him?
8 weeks old.
He was 8 weeks old?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Then there's epigenetics involved in here as well. Whoa. My God, boy or girl?
Boy.
And pooping and peeing? Will he go in his bed? Or do they crate him? They probably don't crate him.
I don't really have to do that much after, to be honest. I don't know. My sister watched the dog for the months and it peed on the bed.
What kind of dog?
Yorkie.
For me, what I would do is limit the dog's access to anything. So I would have the dog in a crate in the car and then probably have him in a puppy pen. Remember that first thing about controlling the environment?
Yeah, right. But I'm just asking, on a table. You mean
on a table is odd.
That's a lot of effort.
Yeah, that is very odd. You know, if I weren't me, I'd be saying maybe dominance, but I just cannot imagine. You know, if you go on a trail and you see where coyotes have gone to the bathroom and raccoons and whatnot, they go on the little hillocks.
Yeah.
So this is kind of marking to say, I am here, I am important. It isn't necessarily dominating anything, but it's just saying, I am here. And that's what it sounds like. It just sounds like, I am here, which is weird on a dining room table, for sure.
And the other thing, because I have a friend, and she says, well, he's mad at me.
Oh, yeah.
And I keep going, I don't know, but it's a little
important. How often do you pee when you get mad at somebody? I'm sorry, I know that's unfair, but it is actually, there are very occasional times when a dog will urinate because they are upset. Okay, so instead of thinking angry at, because they're not doing it to them, people, we're egotists. We think everything is about us. right? But the dog thinks everything is about them because everybody's a hero of their own story. So he's not thinking, I'm going to pay you back. He's thinking, I'm upset, and that might cause him to have to go to the bathroom. Okay? And then if he does it, but if he does it on their bed, then he is paying them back, and he must be a dachshund. I've actually seen many dachshunds that do that. You know, but cats definitely will. So I suppose there's no reason on earth why dogs cannot do it. It's just not normally in their behavior style. But cats absolutely will do it, and it's a way of showing displeasure.
Yes.
And it's a very effective way of showing displeasure.
Yes.
Works for me.
Smell.
Yeah.
In your experience, what are the most fearful breeds?
Oh, what a question. What is
the most fearful breed?
Chow-chows.
What?
Chows?
They're not fearful. They shouldn't be. Yeah. I've seen maybe a couple of churches, but most of them are actually pretty confident. Be more like German Shepherds have a tendency to have a lot of fear. I would say Chihuahuas. There are more fearful Chihuahuas, I think, but on the other hand, there are more Chihuahuas.
Yeah.
So if if you're trying to get percentages, what do you guys think?
They're not socialized. People don't do the work.
Yeah.
And there are so many of them, so you just get a huge amount of people who think that they're just an accessory and don't let them be exposure.
Yeah. They're an accessory? Yeah, they are. I really have seen, I mean, I'm just thinking of shelter work, and we used to see so many scared to death Chihuahuas. And I don't know whether it's genetic. I think it's probably a combination of genetics and socialization. But I'd say of the large dogs, the herding dogs have a tendency to carry a lot of fear with them.
And does that go along with the protection?
Yes, it does. It goes along with suspicion and caution. So then so you're going to see a lot of that just floating around in there. That's one of the reasons why socialization with those particular breeds is more important. Well, it's important for all of them, but they need to see things that have the potential to make them scared. So if I had a border collie, which they're going to grow up and be suspicious of anything that's new and different, you would try to show them almost everything you can that's new and different and let them have the opportunity to explore it so that they can start thinking. Because the essence of fear is that the dog is not thinking, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have a type of dog that has a tendency to not think, or to be fearful, then giving them the opportunity to think is a really important consideration. I'm trying to think if there's anything, any other dog that has that tendency.
Are you, when you're thinking about fearful, are you thinking of like a fearful dog that will retreat or fearful and then go?
Any kind of fear,
okay.
Any kind of fear. Just, you know, because dogs that retreat, many times if you corner them, they will bite. So they will use a retreat until they have to bite. And then there are other dogs that will use that quickly first. And usually they may be fearful as well. And then there are those poor conflicted ones like the Pit Rhodesian Ridgeback that would go, oh, I like you. Oh my God, you moved! You know. So those kind of fearful dogs.
So when you were talking earlier, someone was asking a question about the different traits of breeds and then you interbreed them. And then, so when you have the Ridgeback and the Pit, so you have the kind of the suspicion and the fear, then you have the frontal approach, right? So how about like...
So you get a very complicated dog.
Yeah.
What approach would you use to training? If you have a mixed breed and it looks like a border collie, but acts like a terrier, what's your training method?
It would probably be fairly cautious, fairly slow, with an awful lot of checking in with the owner. So you'd want to make sure that you don't just barrel through with a dog like that. You don't kind of go, everything's going to be okay. With some dogs, you just do that. They start to weird out and you kind of go, no, we're just going to go through, everything's going to be fine. And then they go, okay, yes ma'am, we got that. But for a dog like that, they're not going to let go of it. So you have to go pretty slow, which nobody wants to do. Everybody wants to barrel through this stuff.
Trish, Do, accommodate my question. Some dogs react negatively to men.
Oh, yes, they do.
Than to females. What is that about? Is that the testosterone? Is that the...
I think it's testosterone. I also think that there are some things that are pretty self-evident, like somebody, men tend to be taller. They tend to be hairier in odd places. not just here.
Yeah. Definitely not there.
Yeah, sometimes some of them are not there at
not
all.
Not there at all.
and they have big voices, and their culture is different than ours, than women's culture. Women's culture is kind of almost conciliatory, and is certainly a lot more overtly friendly. Men's culture is almost always competitive. And there are all the competitive stuff that goes along with it is taken, you know, to anything. They don't mean to do it, but it's like when they meet you, it's kind of just very straightforward. And when they see a dog, it's very straightforward with an awful lot of direct eye contact. So the other thing that's probably even more important than that is that most dogs are raised by women. So they don't, especially in shelter environments. There is probably 10 women to every man in a shelter environment. And that's why we love our Larrys, okay? Because what happens is that the women are more nurturing and they're more caretakers. And so they end up working in the shelter. And so the dogs get used to that and they think we're one species and men are another species. And so men are perceived as a threat. Yeah.
Earlier you started to mention some of the breeds that you don't and won't work with. Like you mentioned King Corso.
Connie Corso, yeah.
What other breeds do you
Portuguese
water dog? Well, the Portuguese water dog, I'll work with the Portuguese water dog. I just wouldn't work with the Portuguese water dog under the circumstances. Now, really the big ones, I know I can't control them. The big mastiff dogs. And I think that I would be doing my clients a disservice to show up and say, oh yeah, I can control this dog. I remember working with a big flock guard a couple of years ago and thinking, he could actually walk away with me. And my rule for my new clients is if you can't pick it up, don't buy it. Because people are, if they had German Shepherds when they're 25 years old, they think they can have them when they're 75 years old. And they really shouldn't. So they really need to be able to pick up and control their own dogs, and many people can't. The other thing, though, is like, if I'm afraid of the dog, then I won't work with it. So if I go into a home, and like the little pig yesterday, he was intimidating, he was definitely intimidating to me, but once I got to know him, I think he'd be fine with me. It wasn't like I was really scared of him. But there have been dogs that I've been just terrified of. And I remember one particular dog where I never sat down. Because as soon as you sit down, you make yourself smaller, you make yourself more vulnerable. Well, I shouldn't work with a dog like that, should I? The other kinds of dogs I won't work with are dogs that people that, you know, the owner is... There are some dogs that work better with men. There really are. There are some dogs that actually do better with men. And so I will send, I have a old student who lives in the East Bay who I think is an absolutely stupendous trainer, and I try to send him more and more dogs all the time. All in the East Bay, but they're all like that big. He has two, what are the African dogs?
Borbles.
He has two Borbles and a 4-year-old child. He knows what he's doing. His dogs are really good. So, you know, that's what I would do. I just want to give my clients the service that they need to get.
Is he force free, balanced?
He's totally force free. He's absolutely. He took I think the last class he took was at HSSV, and he was really funny because he was talking about his Borbles. They're very territorial, like all the Mastiffs, extremely protective. And so we're going, what do you do when somebody comes to the door? Because, you know, these are two dogs that are about 150, 160 pounds each. And I could just see him going, no, you can't do this. You know? So he said, well, I call them both to me, because we were talking about the whole recall you know, because I use that for her when somebody comes to the door, as I use a recall and then I find it and all that kind of stuff, even though I just want to say shop. So he said they bark at the door, and then he calls them into the kitchen, and he gets out a plate, and then he very slowly gets out cheese and other stuff, and he starts taking all the paper off like this, and he says the dog is sitting there drooling, you know, and his wife is answering the door.
Oh.
And then he's got this, and then he goes, okay, now you sit, now here he comes, and just everything. He sits, it usually takes 10 minutes to give them something. So we're all like, well, that's pretty good. So, but that's the kind of stuff he does.
But what does he do once the person's in the house?
Then they're fine. Then they're fine. You know, lots of dogs are fine as soon as somebody gets in. It's just that doorway.
Yeah.
And that's the place where they can't handle the doorway. I assume he puts them away. He's pretty good. So I would assume he puts them away. Anything else? Yeah.
When you're in that situation of being with a dog that you realize that you don't want to handle or can't deal with the situation, how do you remove yourself from that? You know, what do you say to your client? How do you work?
It's usually something along the lines of, you know, I'm not sure that I'm the person that should be handling this. I have a couple of people that I'd like to refer. And I try to do it over the phone. And I try to say something like, how big is this dog? What is a dog's problem? If it's a dog that doesn't like people and it's over 50 or 60 maybe pounds, I'm probably not going to like the dog. Although that's not quite true. If it's a German Shepherd, I'm usually okay with it. You know, so a lot of it has to do with breed, a lot of it has to do with the way the person sounds on the phone. And then I do have some referrals that I go to, and there are some that are not horse free. They're definitely in the realm of, you know, balanced trainers, I guess is what they want to call themselves. And they will use, because that's sometimes what some of those dogs actually probably need, which I probably should talk about. I mean, honestly, I tend to be pretty positive, although I can go, you know, I can use other methods if it seems to be, but I, you know, it seems to be warranted, but I will choose positive methods first. That's kind of where I want to go. But there are some dogs that if you use positive methods, they take advantage of you. And it's not that they're horrible dogs, it's just that they need a firmer hand. We were talking about the Labs and Goldens and the fact that they're pretty tough, and the hunters are pretty tough in the way that they train them. Well, just imagine that for some other dogs as well, maybe some of the Mastiffs or whatever, that they just need a firmer hand. And if you're not capable of giving that firm hand, somebody has to be. So, on the other hand, I just really hate to refer to somebody that I know might treat all dogs the same way. So it's tough. It's actually really tough to do that.
And if you're in the situation where you've got to the house, because you're being growled at and you want to get out.
Well, I'm very, you know, if I'm sitting there and a dog is growling, yes, can you get your leash on the dog and then pull the dog away? And it's usually very calm. Because the dog is standing there, I'm sitting there, and I'm going, I think you need to put your dog on a leash. Do you mind doing that? That'd be really great. Thank you so much. And then, you know, and then we talk about it, and then I go, and then, I mean, then it may be a come to Jesus meeting at that point. It may be like, how bad is this dog? How often does this dog do this? Should we be talking about something other than training? Should we be talking about perhaps the idea that you cannot keep this dog, this dog is dangerous? And I'm happy to go there. I mean, not happy, but I'm very, very comfortable with that. I've done that for years and years and years. Let's walk this path. You have to decide, but I'm going to tell you what happens. Your life is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and this is not where you probably want
to go. And you can't go with it. You don't have to keep the dog.
Yeah, well, the problem is if the dog is growling at you and they don't keep the dog, where does the dog go?
Yeah.
So now we got to go down the path of euthanasia.
Yeah.
You go down that path and it's a, you
You're
know.
Not always ready that, like, because we, you know, we have consults all the time where it takes time for people to even
adjust think about it
to the idea that this isn't something you can work with, let alone the idea that maybe
it's going to be euthanasia.
So sometimes it's...
That's why I used to assist at euthanasias all the time. okay, I'm going to take your dog, and I'm going to make sure your dog is nicely, you know, I would never leave somebody hanging. Your dog should be put to sleep and then not help.
I can tell you, as a person who did that, that I appreciated it so much, because you, had we not seen what we saw at that console, we probably would have continued to work and for years.
And he, Buster would have bitten somebody.
And he could have killed the child across the street.
Yeah.
So I just, even though it was devastating, it's like, I think honesty is the best policy, but you're very compassionate. And so it's not just like, oh, you're stupid.
You have to, yeah. I mean, there's some of these guys that I refer to, they'll go, oh, that's an unsound dog. Kill it and get a new one.
Yeah.
Ah! You know, and that's probably the, you know, that's the most horrible thing you could say to somebody. Yeah.
So for being the ACO, I saw people who were like, oh, my dog's friendly, like all the time. My dog's friendly. And
they're not.
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, Pam, I care, right. You know, like, you know, give me the whale, you know, just everything. And, you know, or, you know, we have to go in and just straight use a catch bowl or something. But anyways, on the other side of it, you know, where you have people who are wanting to training dogs, yeah, like how much in denial are they, you know, of seeing the behavior, you know, like bringing into the house of this dog's friend. You know, most people I assume here would know, like, to warn the trainer, put the dog in a crate or another room, you know, so that.
But they don't.
Right, yeah, so what's like, yeah, what, like, on, I don't know, on a scale of 1 to 10 for being in denial and knowing that their dog's, like, that their dog is dangerous or, you know, maybe.
I think most people are definitely in a state of denial because their dog has never bitten. Once they've bitten, they know the dog can bite. But most people are just like, oh, if you just, you know, if you stand still, don't look at him and hold your hands up, fine. And you're like, okay, this is good. I like this, you know. And I can't tell you, at least once a week I get this. You know, just stand still and don't look at them. And I say, you tell all your owners to do, your friends to do that? Yeah. You got good friends.
Yeah.
Well, actually what is ends up happening is they don't have any friends anymore.
Yeah.
Because nobody will come over and just stand still and be growled at and barked at and stuff like that. Now, what I tell the dog, particularly if it's a big dog, but even if it's a small dog, is please control your dog before I come over. I usually actually add a line that I'm a good trainer and a good consultant, but I'm not a very good magician. I can't.
Very good what?
Magician. I can't fix your dog by kind of walking in the door. But people expect that.
Sure.
They open the door and the dog is racing towards you and they're going, I wanted you to see this. Okay. I saw it. Let's
now
get the dog back inside.
It.
It really is. It really is funny. I have to write a book, honest to God.
Yeah.
You know, about the people involved with the dogs.
Yeah,
you know.
You should
absolutely.
You're a good writer.
You know what you're
doing.
You
know?
Just it's all funny. Okay, I think we've gone over a little bit. So have we? Yeah, a little bit. So this is it for this class. Was this good? Did it cover a lot of stuff?
Yeah, very great. It should be long.
And